You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome to the Lorehounds Podcast. We're the Lorehounds, your guides to psychohistory. I'm John.
And I'm Marilyn. This is our coverage of Foundation on Apple TV Plus, Season 3, Episode 7, Foundation's End. If you want to get in contact with us, send an email please, to theempire@thelorehounds.com, or head to our Discord server from the link tree in the show notes.
And if you like what you've heard and want to support us or get ad-free and bonus content, check the same link tree for our Patreon and Supercast subscription options. One of the other thing I'll note is if you want to, you know, for free, do something nice for us, if you've been enjoying the content, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts especially.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I've realized that if I don't say that at some point in the season, only the people with mean things to say will leave a review.
That gets old.
Yeah, you know, let's spread some positivity. If you want to just send some good vibes, a 5-star review goes a long way.
We will definitely appreciate any 5-star reviews and kind compliments that come in our direction.
Absolutely. So thank you all for being here with us for another big episode of Foundation. Big reveals, big moments. I mean, come on. Marilyn, what'd you think?
So much here. It's just hard to keep it all straight. I had to do a couple of watch-throughs. There's also a lot more book points popping up at me. The fact that I'm currently reading the two prequel novels helps enormously because there's a lot of stuff that I would have completely forgotten appeared there. So it's a nice synergy right now. And there were one or two surprises, which of course we always like a good surprise, an interesting surprise.
Right.
And my gosh, a ton of opportunities for speculations, all kinds of new things coming out and thinking, oh, well, what does that mean? And I think they're still firing on all cylinders, plot-wise, visually, musically, just everything, the acting, the costumes. There's only one real challenge based upon some choices they've made in terms of how they're going to realize the plot, and we'll see where that goes, and I'll bring that up a little bit more later on. How about you?
I thought it was fantastic, and I think we had a reveal that was 3 seasons in the making with Rhea Demerzel. Really enjoying where we're going with the day plot line with these robot journeys. I love the fever dream. That was very cool. The visuals are amazing. Like the painting coming alive was absolutely fantastic. It was breathtakingly beautiful. And then we have everything going on the New Terminus Foundation, on the first foundation. And my God, What a fell swoop of a conquest by the mule.
Definitely. And of course, knowing the plot generally, I knew what was coming. But the book doesn't really spend a lot of time in that. And Asimov, of course, famously not a fan of war, not a fan of violence and conflict and so on. So he just kind of brushes over all that. But here it's being presented to us. And it's intense.
Yeah, I mean, Inber is interesting because you want to hate him for like the whole season, and then that happens and you go, oh, but I didn't want him to go out like that. Like, that's pretty dark.
Yeah, well, they have some dark turns in this season, all 3 seasons, to be honest.
So, yeah, they do.
I think it was probably fairly predictable. In fact, that ties in with one major comment that I'll have when we get to that point.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the mule backstory or supposed backstory, right? Because
I
will be honest with you. I thought they were blowing up some theories of mine the whole time. Awesome. And then by the end, I'm like, no, my theory holds strong.
Yep, I think it does.
And when I say my theory, I think probably every book reader's theory. I don't think we're special for having these theories. This is what the show is trying to lead us to. Yeah. I've been checking Reddit to see if people are thinking the same thing, and mm-hmm. it seems like that's part of the zeitgeist right now. I will compliment the moderators of the Foundation subreddit, Foundation TV subreddit. They have dedicated threads for book and non-book readers.
Yeah, well, that's great. Yeah. And we do too, actually, on our Discord channel.
Yeah, we do have a specific book thread, and then we have individual non-book threads with strict spoiler rules.
Yes.
So, yeah. Anyway, so come chat with us on Discord. But anyway, my point is, I think this is going in a really interesting direction. I love Harry Seldon as sort of the wink and the nod towards us.
For sure.
What better role can you have Jared Harris do than a wink and a nod at the audience?
He does that so well, does he not?
He does.
He does indeed. And it could still go either way. That's what's so wonderful about how they're presenting it. I feel reasonably confident in our mutually shared expectation regarding that. But, I'm not putting it past them. They've still got three more episodes. And given the number of flips and twists that have already presented to us, there's probably more waiting in the wings.
Yeah, they could be. There is an equal probability that they are faking out the book readers and the non-book readers.
Exactly.
Right? And I think that's really good writing because it's keeping us on our toes.
Unquestionably. And pleasantly so.
Right.
There are times when, other adaptations, if they start to seem to go off the rails and you think, well, I guess they're doing this to give us, readers, quote unquote, suspense.
Right.
Thanks. I'd really appreciate it if you would just stick to sort of, the basic.
Yeah.
The basic sauce, if not, point by point plots, you don't have to do that. But that's what I like about how they're handling this. They're putting in all these book points here, there, and everywhere. But at the same time, they are telling their own story. And it's just really fun to see how they're weaving it in and how much, in fact, they're not contradicting.
Right.
When you think they might be.
Yeah, really interesting how they're sticking really closer to the books on some things, and some things you're like, huh.
Yeah.
That is an interesting twist. Especially with the Cleons, of course. The Cleons not a part of the books at all. And the Empire wasn't really involved in this part of the story.
Well, not to our knowledge. I mean, we didn't see their involvement. I'm sure there was involvement going on, but we just didn't see it because that was not the viewpoint.
Right. Anyway, why don't we get right into the episode, and we're going to start with the mule's tale. Years ago on Rossum, a young mule harvests produce with his mother and baby brother. When they see the pullers and assessors arrive, they race home to hide the baby. The Foundation assessors arrive, find the baby, and tell the family they'll be back to get rid of the child in 30 days, as there is a one-child policy. Before they can return, the mule and family go to a body of water, where the mule's father grabs him and attempts to drown the elder son. The mule's powers awaken, and he forces his parents to drown themselves. He leaves the baby with the neighbors. After the mule finishes telling his story to Vault Harry Seldon, the projection questions its veracity.
Yeah. Yes, they say Rossum at the end of the outer rim, quote unquote, years ago, which I think is very coy of them. They were not knowing how many years ago.
Yeah, and can I also say amazing casting for a young mule? Just to look at that actor compared to the older actor, that's amazing casting.
Well, and
they
look
so similar.
Haircut and whatnot can also contribute to that.
But the eyes were like the same. That was crazy.
Yeah. Well, and he's a very gifted actor to be able to.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in similar ways that the three Cleons have been, studying each other's walk and gait, and, we've seen in this season, this Dawn slowly approaching his way to the middle throne and taking on more and more the mannerisms that we have seen in Day. And in other days in the past, So that's definitely a theme for this. But yeah I think they're definitely coding this person as being a young mule. I can still say, yeah, I suppose that's possible, but I'm not going to absolutely commit to it at this point. It isn't over till it's over. What I found interesting with this section is here for the first time, we see something of the dark side of the Foundation in the way that they're treating their quote unquote food planets and the people who work on them. You know, it really does mm-hmm. seem pretty oppressive to me.
Now, can I ask you, though, do you think that this is how the Foundation worked for a long time, or do you think this is an Inberism?
No, I think this is an Inber, or, you know, mm-hmm. if not this particular Inber, his predecessor, whatever, because, you know, it clearly has been going on for at least a generation. But no, it's already been made clear to us, actually, last episode, Vault Harry actually says, you know, one is too... undisciplined and the other is too authoritarian. And this is so authoritarian that I'm thinking stormtroopers.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And I mean,
things that we saw in Andor, the second season.
Yeah, but we've seen real life one child policies happen. And
yes, we have.
I almost thought to myself, like, the real life one child policies actually caused a lot more problems than they solved, even if you take away the inhumanity of them.
That's right.
And so it almost doesn't feel very Foundation to me to have such a short-sighted policy.
Well, except that these are not, I'm not sure that these people are even viewed as Foundation citizens. I don't even know if they're Foundation citizens or not. They are resources to be exploited to the extent that it is possible. And they've calculated how many calories
mm-hmm.
a person needs to survive and to mm-hmm. do this kind of work and survive. And I'm sure that they titrate it from infant to young child to adult allocations or whatever.
But at the same time, if the Foundation is taking responsibility for allotting things and making sure the resources are enough to go around, isn't it irresponsible to say, well, don't like a two-child policy, maybe you could support that, right? Replace both people.
Replacement policy.
A one-child policy says the next generation will be able to produce less than the one currently.
Unless you're constantly bringing in bodies to work the fields, you know?
But at some point, you have to make the people, right? Like, there has to be people.
Well, sure. Maybe there's another planet with overpopulation, and so they just trans... I don't know. I'm making things up.
I just think it seems very short-sighted for the Foundation.
Of course it does. But, you know, this particular iteration of Foundation and its rulers...
They're short-sighted.
Sure how much long sight they have, to be perfectly honest.
And of course, I'm brushing aside the humanity of it, too, which is terrible. I mean, I did always like the George Carlin joke where he says, replace yourself. Don't even replace your husband. Hasn't he done enough? And
okay.
But that comedy aside, I mean, it's terrible to be, you know, telling people how many children they can have and to rule in this kind of, like you say, authoritarian way. Mm-hmm. And that combined with the lack of planning, in my view, is just, it shows why the Inver regime was unsustainable.
Definitely. I mean, it's resource colonization.
Yeah.
At its most brutal.
Yeah.
And people reduced to resources that produce resources.
Right.
And in people's minds whose minds work this way, it's, well, we can always replace that particular type of resource. And of course, the answer is no, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Not even the food that you're producing, if you're not producing sustainably. And we don't even know about that. But frankly, they code us with these massive round wheel machines that are, you know, trampling along and, you know, the dust goes everywhere. And I'm thinking, it doesn't look all that sustainable to me.
No.
Somehow.
Especially, like, those machines did not look like they were picking up a lot of the crops, right? They just looked like they were ripping it out of the ground.
I couldn't figure it out at all, to be frank. I really couldn't see how this was supposed to be working. So,
yeah, I don't understand. It didn't seem efficient at all. And you know, that is a thing that you see, you know, in factory farming. Like, I remember... My friend's mother taught me how to make pesto.
Oh.
And she said, hey, if you get the basil out of your garden, if you pick the leaves individually, you can just, you know, do a quick rinse in the sink
Right.
But if you buy it at the store, they're ripping out the whole plant.
Yeah.
And so the dirt gets everywhere. So you really have to like scrub the leaves.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was like, wow, I never thought of it that way. But that I think about that all the time with like produce now.
I believe you. No, that it's a good point. And, you know, the older child says to his mother, you know, but the mother says, oh, they're harvesting before we've been able to glean. And the younger child says, no, we'll be able to glean after, which is kind of a throwback to the story of Rachel and Ruth, and, excuse me, Ruth in the Bible and Ruth and Naomi and the, you know, the gleaners who were allowed to come in after the rich farmers' fields had been harvested properly. And if they left any, they were allowed to take that. And sometimes the good rich farmers would actually deliberately leave some stuff behind to be gleaned. Well, I don't think there's any touch of that here.
Right. Well, it's part of Jewish law, you know, to leave a portion unharvested.
I didn't know it was coded in the law, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's a part. It's to leave a portion unharvested for the for the poor, for the the people who need it.
The people who don't have their own fields.
And it's seen as, and I always thought this was very cool, it's seen as a kinder charity because it gives some agency to to people to, you know, go in and pick their own food and feel like they have some level of control over it.
It's not merely handouts.
Right. Which, by the way, I have no problem with handouts. Let's hand people things they need.
Seriously.
But I did always like that idea of like, and of course some people aren't going to be able to pick the fields, and so that's a problem too.
Right,
so let's not, I don't want to act like I'm against handouts here. But I did always like that idea of like, just leave a little bit for someone who needs something to go take.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the whole idea of the dignity of the individual, which is important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's pretty horrible to think that your parents would drown you for the sake of a baby sibling who, you know, who knows what their personality is going to be at this point. So one can have enormous sympathy with the older child, regardless of what actually happened here. And I'm suddenly thinking there's a touch of the Gales at this point, because both of them enter their powers and feel them functioning when they are drowning or feel like they are drowning. And just a note here, there's an awful lot of drowning in this episode.
Yeah, right?
Wow, I and even more that. Than that, I for the first time, you know, there's drowning throughout the whole season.
Yeah.
You know, right back to season one, you know, Synax's method of execution and the fact that the planet is drowning. We then see it later after it's drowned. And we have Gale and her future visioning, and we have this older brother and then his parents. And, oh, yes, there's some more drowning to come. So it does seem to be an ongoing thing. So can I offer you a speculation?
I think you should save this one for after the credits.
Okay.
You're gonna,
that's why I separated it
you're
out.
Gonna, yeah, I'll copy paste it till our post credit.
Fair enough.
I'm reading it and I'm like, oh man, we're gonna get deep into spoilers here.
Yeah. But it is interesting to jump way ahead in terms of the chronology of the episode to the very end, where the victorious mule strides up to the vault and basically tells it its life story.
Yeah.
And winds it all up by saying, well, the pirates never took as much as you did.
And a very interesting thing I took up with a pirate, right?
Yes,
I took up with a pirate.
Yes.
I want to come back to that post-credit too.
All right, good. Good.
I'm going to jot that down.
Noted. Yes. Yeah, I had the same phrase here. After his youth, he escaped from Ross, and he took up with pirates. So unconsciously, that phrasing struck me too. And doubtless they were brutal, but not the same type of brutality that he experienced as a child on Foundation Food Planet.
Yeah.
But although, who knows, maybe they were drowning people too. I shouldn't assume, should I? So it was a lovely surprise and startlement when after he finishes telling his story, this is after the closing of the vault, after the mule attack, right? And suddenly we hear Hari saying, sounds like a sad story. I wonder how much of it is true. And I wonder too. I'll just put that out there for now. So it seems that the vault is still ticking over, you know, that when I first saw it the first time, I thought, oh my lord, did they kill the vault too? Because of the way it changed from the crystal palace mm-hmm. to this blackened shape. And the ground around it was blackened and, you know, it was smoking and all this stuff. And I thought, oh.
It's like a mood ring for Harry Seldon.
Well, but I subsequently remembered, oh yeah, after people are done with, you know, the annual or whatever it was, the crisis visit or, you know, sneaking in like Edling Miss, like countering the Nullfield or whatever it happens to be, when he's done talking, the vault does the same kind of thing and it rises up from the ground so right. that it's high enough so that you can't, you know, just sort of jump up and climb in or whatever.
Right. I don't even think the vault moved or actually opened for Ebling Miss. I think.
No, it didn't. But he got
just
in.
Like sort of teleported him in.
He was the one who snuck in, as it were.
Right.
And interesting, the mule responds, oh, the truth comes begging to your door, Harriton Seldon. Now, what does Harriton mean? What does it signify? Whoever called
him
Harriton.
I didn't even notice that.
Harriton? I'm pretty sure he says it.
Huh.
I still don't have closed caption. So I'm just going by what I think I hear. And I did see it, what is it, 2 times or 3 times? I think it was 3 times. And there's something. It's not just plain Harry Seldon.
Okay.
But maybe right. maybe it's just something else that I just was never really catching clearly, but we'll be interested.
Harry damn Seldon or something. I don't know. Maybe I got to go back and check this.
Yeah. Listeners, write in.
We often only get feedback when we get something wrong. So that's why I haven't had a lot of feedback this season, because we're just that good, Marilyn.
Well, gosh, maybe we should start throwing in an error here or there, John.
Yeah. Remember when the mule took over Synax?
Not quite so obvious an error, maybe. A little more subtle.
I just got to say about this whole mule's journey. If this is true, and I am very doubtful that this is true, if this is true, what would make you more psychologically damaged than your parents trying to kill you and then needing to flip it around?
Exactly.
Like, I mean, that would make you... I mean, different people have different reactions, but like, it totally makes sense that he ends up a psychopath, a murderous psychopath.
And one can question, why are they knocking off the older kid? Is it just that babies are always cuter by nature? I mean,
couldn't bring yourself to kill a baby, but like, wouldn't you be more bonded to the one that's actually a fully formed person?
And wouldn't this fully formed person be more functional on the farm? Look at all the helpful things he's doing.
Right.
You know, he's growing sprouts indoors. He's reassuring his mother that they'll be able to glean afterwards. I mean, he's definitely a contributing member. He also eats more food. There's no doubt about that.
You know?
And I don't know if they scale the amount of calories according to the size of each person or not. Or maybe age rather than size. They don't care what size.
Yeah, that I don't know.
Yeah, it is pretty awful, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think you can reflect on the fact that, you know, a lot of what brings this about is the greater awfulness of the authoritarian approach that produces things like resource colonization and complete and utter disregard for human life in preference to these resources.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the real villain here was the Foundation, right? I do believe this resource colonization thing, right? I think that part of the story is true. I am not convinced that this all happened to this person, and I'm not convinced that this particular story in it is true.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And I also recognize that they, in previous episodes, they sort of seeded this idea of food planets, because when Gail is trying desperately to corral the mule, she's saying, we have to do this because if we don't, he's going to have all the food planets, is all this. So that kind of nicely, you'll pardon the pun, implanted the idea that there are some planets in the Empire that are strictly viewed as food planets.
Right.
And so why not Foundation developing that same view? Because they originated in an empire.
Right. No, I think that's right. I mean, you're going to have your bread baskets, right? You're going to have your areas where where you're going to grow your food. I mean, every country has that.
Yes.
And, you know, this is just a bigger version of that.
Right. We have global bread baskets, and now this is galactic bread baskets.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, why don't we take a quick break? And when we get back, we'll talk about Foundation's End.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
We're back. Well, Han Pritchard panics. The Foundation submits to the mule, who declares himself first citizen. After being baptized in blood, the mayor shows the mule to his new office. There, the mule orders Inber to drown himself, which he does with pleasure. Han escapes by injuring himself to get the door open and heads planetside on an unknown mission. His friend tells the mule he's likely halfway through creating an insurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely, right? I do buy it. I actually, I don't know. I think that perhaps she doesn't know enough about Han to know what he will do. And I think that that may be a bit of a red herring for the audience.
Well, my first thought was he headed down to the planet's surface rather than head to Second Foundation because he didn't want to be tracked.
That's true. He could get down to the surface and then take another ship, right?
Or something.
Right.
Or something. Yeah. Yeah, I'm noticing now that the theme that Bear has scored for the mule sounds rather Middle Eastern to me, or at least sort of
You know,
that similar kind of scale. I don't know if it's pentatonic or not. Mark, if you're listening, let us know.
Mark, it sounded modal, actually.
Modal is a good way of putting it. Yeah. I thought that Pritch's friend on the Force, air quotes around friend, might help him to kill himself rather than be tortured. But it seems he does have his own version of a cyanide pill, and it does not look comfortable.
No.
Absolutely painful. But then, this gotcha later on, you know, the audience, the last time we saw him, he was shrieking in pain, and the blood was spurting, and he fell down. They opened the door, and the next thing you see is a very bloody Han Pritchard body lying on the floor, and they think, oh, well, there's that. But no. And I want to know, how did they create that illusion? How did he create that illusion?
Well, he's Second Foundation. We know that now.
But did he plant the vision in people's brains?
I think so.
Because I thought that it was a physical, tangible body.
I think he used real clothes. And then it was an illusion implanted in minds with his Second Foundation powers.
So he had two sets of clothing? I mean, they stripped
him. I mean, he could have grabbed it at some point. Right?
Because
he was outside of the cell, wasn't he?
Well, that's true.
Yeah, he was outside
somehow,
of the cell.
But how did he get outside of the cell? I mean, there's
He opened, the cell got open to treat him. He came in and killed or incapacitated that guard. And then he swapped some things out.
And all this happens before Inber and the mule come along.
Yeah. He planted he made that whole scene. And then the double gotcha of him pointing the gun at the mule, hitting fire, and then what was it? Fire rejected.
Yeah. No, it was touching that he thought he could assassinate the mule with a handgun.
Yeah, right.
Just saying.
I mean, he's as human as anybody else physically, right? So
sure.
So.
And yet it's interesting, since the mule had already encountered him before and knew that he was of a similar capacity as himself, mm-hmm. in terms of the mind stuff, why did the mule not just try to take him over from the very beginning?
And it's why a great did question.
Not, you know, succumb to that. I mean, why use the more clumsy,
right?
You know, handgun and whatever thing.
It's
very nice visual, but not terribly consistent in some respects, I think.
It's a great question. Why did Han going near the mule not trigger that same like resistance?
Right.
It's all part of some things that I would like to discuss after the credits. We're going to do a book spoiler after the credit theory corner, okay?
Let's put a pin in that.
Yeah.
And, you know, moving on here, Inber clearly did not hold out very long against the mule's persuasion, but I never for a moment thought that moral fiber and strength were Inber's middle names. So
No.
Not a lot of surprise here, I'm afraid. And then we get more drowning, as I mentioned earlier on, along with the Rust parents and Mavin. Well, let's not forget Mavin died by drowning.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he was already shot to death, so.
Yeah, but I think
but that was. But from the way they presented his face and his very swollen tongue and all, I think there is a suggestion that, you know, he was still drowned as well.
Yeah, perhaps.
Shot. And I love the transition they do from that. They have that scene of the last image of the mule departing after having dropped his baby sibling off on the neighbor's doorstep, and he runs away, and the perspective, the grass sort of rises up, and then suddenly it's the grass outside the vault, and there's the grown-up mule standing there doing his best to confront Harry Seldon. Nice transition there. So yeah, I wonder how many more drownings we're going to be looking at, or bodies hurtled into water or whatever.
Yeah, there is an awful lot of drowning. The visuals in the show are always 10 out of 10. I mean, this is, I think, Apple's flagship pretty sci-fi show.
It certainly aces it in that regard. Pretty much every single episode.
Yeah.
In fact,
it sure does.
If part of the reason why they pulled back on David Goyer was because of the expenditures, I'm really not seeing any sign of it in the visuals at all. So,
well, sure. No, I think they're cutting the budget a lot more for season 4.
Oh, okay.
That was going to happen more. I think they did cut the budget a bit for season 3 too. I could be wrong about all this, but I think that was part of why David Goyer wanted to leave. But the other part was everything got delayed with the strikes and everything, and he's just been away from his family so much. It's a show that you have to be on site for a lot of it in Europe and whatnot.
Sure.
So, he didn't want to do that for so many more years.
Yeah.
I don't blame him.
No, I don't either. And yet, again, listening to the Bald Move podcast on episode by episode of this same show, they also talked to Goyer at one point. Or no, they wrote, and they got a letter back from him. And it turns out he's just completely dropped it. He's not following the episodes. He just has completely shut it out of his life. So. That says something to me about, you know, how important this was to him and the depth to which he had committed himself to it. So
yeah.
It's sad.
Yeah, it is. I wish he had been able to do the series the way he wanted to. And it sounds like he did for the first 3 seasons, at least the first 2.
Right.
So I'm really enjoying his vision so far. I hope that the next showrunner sticks with that vision, because it's a really special one.
I hope so. I have a hard time imagining how it could be improved, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
We shall see.
Well, why don't we talk about Empire itself?
Let's do.
Dusk sits alone on his throne while the Galactic Council demands answers. He orders them to send probes to New Terminus and recall any of the fleet that remains. Dusk then visits Ambassador Quent and offers her his protection. While he only has 3 days remaining, he and Quent finally consummate their 30-year will-they-or-won't-they affair. Dusk then kills the ferret created by Day. Was it a ferret? I couldn't remember.
Yes, it's
okay.
A ferret.
Okay,
it's a ferret.
I'm just checking here.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's really interesting how they humanize Dusk so much this season, other than his whole black hole thing?
Well, you see, my big takeaway from all these succession of scenes is he was putting on an act.
Oh, yeah. That's where I was going with that.
So I really did think, oh, wow, he's a softer, kinder Dusk. You know, he's thoughtful. He's caring for these other people. He was really touched by Don's message, et cetera, et cetera. And the ferret, you know, look at that. He's feeding the ferret on his own table and you know.
Right.
And then he walks out and stamps it to death. I mean, it was really a shock. And I thought,
yeah.
Okay, I guess somebody who, you know, could conceive of a black hole weapon probably is just not overflowing with the milk of human kindness or any other kind of kindness.
And that's all of them can do this compassion act, right? They can all act compassionate.
And then
turn on a dime. We saw Day do that with Maven. We saw Dawn do that with the affair partner of politician. And now we're seeing that here with Dusk. So these Kleons, whether this is something that was in the Kleons from the beginning or this is the genetic drift, they are fully capable of psychotic behavior.
Yeah. Yeah, what he did to Capitalist was pretty psychotic.
But also, they're able to hide that. They're able to mask that really well.
Well, it seems to me that maybe not initially, but by now, the tripart empire has had to develop some sense of being able to convince people and to reassure them, and you know, because they're sure not dealing with you know, force and power over anymore. I mean, just picture that crowd of unhappy Trantorians and visiting Foundationers.
Yeah,
and consider the contrast between that chaos in the Imperial Court and the one we saw in the very first season. You know, those iterations of the Empire during Harry Seldon's trial. Can you possibly imagine such scenes unfolding before the Triple Throne of that time?
No.
It's just amazing. And that Dusk would cozy up to any Foundationer after that scene. I mean, how is Trantor even getting transmissions from Foundation at this point? Because, you know, Foundation was being basically fighting for its life.
I like to think that they can send their probes quickly. Let's just say, like, he sent the probes. They're looking at it now.
Well, but I think there was something specific that said, you know, we've been watching transmissions from Foundation. But maybe not. Maybe it was Imperial probes. Instead, an Imperial probe droid. Yeah, and, you know, initially we see Dusk being really upset and disgusted by the appearance of Day's camel and then Capitalist. The appearance of Capitalist, suddenly I wonder where Maven's family is now. Did they escape? Were they executed?
Oh, they were probably either executed or memories wiped and relocated.
That would be the kindest outcome, probably.
Right. Right. Well, the kindest outcome would be to give them his pension and let them live out their lives. But
sure.
Yeah.
Although you could also argue it would be kinder if she never knew that she'd had a husband who had been used.
Oh, no. Let's not get into that ethical debate. I'm going to sidestep that one, Marilyn.
No. I'm not saying for or against. I'm just saying there are multiple perspectives here.
Sure.
And we do have a whole conversation about whether or not you'd rather have your memories back, right?
Right. That's true. And
so
that's true. Interesting. That's up
and
next.
You might think one thing until it has actually happened and, you know, not really appreciate the other. But of course, if your memory's gone, you won't even know, will you? Yeah. You've already mentioned the viewing, visiting this painting and then how it moves later on. I've just always thought it's such a beautiful, beautiful construction. And
yeah, I wonder who made it, right? Like, did they hire a specific painter to do this? Is this a group effort? Is this digitally created?
I think this is a task that all the Dusks take on. Didn't we learn that?
No, I mean in real life.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
I don't think this Dusk actor is painting at all.
Well, this particular iteration of Dusk is probably also not doing much painting at this point.
That's true.
I mean, it could be digital. It could be human. I think I do remember from the first season. I don't know. Maybe I made this up. There may have been some implication that, yes, it was actually painted by humans.
Mm.
So, who knows? All right.
Well, if somebody knows, please write in.
Please.
If not, I'll do some reading before next week's episode.
So it's really fascinating to me the way this Dusk is showing such concern for Quint and saying, you know, you have a safe place in the palace as long as you wish. And then he says, yeah, I'm not going to be dusted in 3 days. So how long is that going to be worth anything in particular once he's gone? But that confession, if you want to call it that, could also have been the impetus for Quint finally initiating physical intimacy with Dusk.
Mm.
You know, when she kisses him, she says, I've wanted to do that for 30 years. So apparently they were an item without benefits up to this point. Which is,
yeah, I thought that they had an affair, but apparently not.
Yeah. I just remember the scene where he shows her the Prime Radiant and she's kind of cuddling up to him and you know, head on his shoulder almost kind of thing. So I don't know. It's interesting. I suppose you could read it any number of ways.
Right.
But I have a feeling, you know, based upon the way he treated Capulus, I think his prime motivation at this point is vengeance for Dawn.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he thinks he can actually outsmart Demerzel and you know, whose clock is ticking for his execution 3 days from now. And maybe he's just going to go full nihilistic.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see in the next scene that Day reminds us that even if you want to free Demerzel, she will not let you because of her programming.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So, you know, absolute thing here. Maybe he's finally decided, all right, if I can't, you know, if it's all falling apart right now, maybe my final act would be to finally take it out. Because remember, we speculated last time that because we know that the black hole that Gal was circling around came right after the fight with Emuel in the Trantor Library.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Dusk just turns the black hole bomb on Trantor.
Hmm.
You know, sort of a good Dameron moment. You know, if it's going to burn, let's have the whole thing burn.
Right. That's really interesting. I didn't think of him doing a self-immolation here.
Well, maybe he figures that's better than just walking tamely in and being dusted. And at the same time, that'll bring an end to Empire. Maybe he also hopes it will bring an end to Demerzel.
Hmm. She's like, nah, I'm good. I have black hole shielding in my programming.
I wonder if she does.
Who knows? All right, well, let's talk about another emperor here.
Yes.
On Mycogen, Songbird and Oceanglass send Day on a spore-induced drug trip where he sees visions of Demerzel raising him as a child. He could never live up to her expectations as she trains him to act as the other Cleons do. He asks Demerzel if she would leave if she could, and she says she cannot weigh love against freedom. She also reveals her previous names, including Daniil. After the trip, the Sunmaster arrives to meet Day.
Yeah, I was quite astounded to learn that Dawn is still alive.
Really? I didn't think they were going to kill him off so quick.
It's true. They had a lot of information that they wanted
Lee to get Pace from a healthy salary, and they're going to milk that for all they can.
Fair point. Not to mention that Oceanglass has a few questions for him.
Right.
And that will ensure that there will be no need for Songbird to have to relive her memories.
That's true. Yeah, and a live prisoner tells more stories than a dead one.
Than a dead one, for sure. Unless you can, you know, read their mind before it disintegrates. I don't know. I wondered how Day knew that the markings on Demerzel's repair tool meant Earth.
Yeah, I don't know.
If this thing was made 5,000 years ago, unless there was something in the painting we were talking about earlier of the history of Demerzel and the Empire and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe when he was a kid, he just asked her and she told him.
Yeah, but that could be. It's just interesting.
I tend to doubt that.
It's just interesting to me because, you know, by this time of the history of the worlds of the Empire, it's mm-hmm. been largely forgotten that Earth was ever involved, that Earth was the birthplace of humanity in the books, I should say.
Oh, yeah. That's completely gone. And an awful lot of people have never even heard the name Earth by this time.
Right.
At least according to the books. Who knows how they're handling that here. But Songbird is quite clear. If there is a synthetic life on Trantor, it could be the most important thing to happen to us in 5,000 years. So she's ready to endure the memories.
Right.
But Ocean Glass, better idea, and they bring out more drugs. And it's interesting, in this instance, Songbird says, spores make you honest. If you want us to believe you, this is how. And Day doesn't look quite as eager to take these drugs as he was to indulge in the other kind. So
no, I think he knows that this is not going to be an easy trip like the other ones were.
Definitely not. Definitely not. It's quite the trip. You know, we start off being trapped in the cloning tank, and then naked and then trapped in the palace. He was granted a belly button at one point, which I found quite fascinating.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah. I can't remember the exact
Right.
text that went along with it, but at one point, when he's the full adult Day, and he's confronting Demoiselle or something or other, and it's not, she doesn't exactly say, I will give you what you want or whatever. That's just this implication, oh, right, you really want it? Here, you can have a belly button, you can be human, instead of being trapped in the whole,
right,
you know, clone cycle.
Right. Demoiselle says, what do you want? Would you want to be born? Would that make you feel whole? Something like that.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Right. And that's really fascinating. I didn't notice that they put a belly button on, but great visual storytelling there.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I've really keyed in on this ever since I read about, you know, how much trouble they had making sure that he didn't have the belly button until they wanted him to. It was a little poignant when Demoiselle asked Day, why do you hate me so? And he responds, what else would I feel for you, my midwife and my martinet?
Mm.
So I remember some people saying, when we were talking about the different clothing styles that Demoiselle has been wearing over these three seasons, the first season, there's a lot of coding in her costumes for governess and nursemaid and all that kind of thing. So he uses the word martinet. She really is his drill sergeant, and that's where he feels he's failed, because that very dramatic scene where the three of them are back sitting at the table and he's still this, you know, maybe 10-year-old. He's a Dawn who will become a Day. We still think of him as Day. This is the current Day's childhood, if you will. I know it's confusing. Anyway, they're sitting at the table and they whip out their napkins, all the same gesture and all, and the youngest just, you know, he whips it out and it flies out of his hand.
Right, but if you have to practice it, was it ever real? Right. And the question is, did previous Cleons have to practice this? Because, sure, they're the same biological DNA, but, like, your experiences also shape you. And, yes, they try to give them as close to an experience as they can, but you're never going to be exact.
Well, and I think I'm reading this as an example of just how far they've drifted genetically.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think so,
season too. One, we did see them do this same thing, and it was all exactly perfectly the same, and they're all drinking their goblets at the same time and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I just read that as no practice needed. It's encoded.
Yeah.
And so they all just do it without even trying. And then by the time we get to the Dawn who realizes he's colorblind and the rest of them aren't, I think by that time he's consciously trying to mimic, because he's not sure that he's closely enough aligned and that he's afraid they're going to knock him off and just bring out a new Dawn because he's defective in some way. And it's only at the end of that whole cycle that they learn that, in fact, oh, by the way, we've all been poisoned with genetic defectiveness, right, or whatever they want to call it. Yeah, so poignant. He says, even at our best, we disappoint. Which, golly, how many kids in their and adults in their childhood have had those same kind of experiences?
Yeah.
From parents, you know, they feel that they are not meeting up to the standards. Whether or not it's true, I mean, sometimes
sometimes really it's self-inflicted, true, but, right? It's just the perception.
It can be. It can be.
Which
it
is why I have always pledged to be very explicit in my praise for my children, because I don't want them to feel like they have to, you know, prove themselves.
Yeah, and interesting that you use that particular phrase, because that very thing comes up at the end of this episode with Randu.
Oh, yeah.
And Torin.
And that's why I say explicit, right? Because,
sure,
a lot of parents give implicit praise. They're like, they go, they just don't say anything for a compliment. They only say something for a negative. Yeah. And I don't want to do that. And I think that it's very important to say your praise out loud.
Well, John, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I think you are an absolutely fantastic and fabulous father. And I think your kids are lucky to be your kids.
Well, I appreciate it, Marilyn. I did have to calm down a child who really wanted to watch TV tonight. So
I'm sure that was an exercise for
both of you. Sure was an exercise in patience. Mm-hmm. But you know what? We read some books and it was all fine. So yeah. Anyway. I wanted to talk about this implication of, you know, why can't, you know, you can't free Demerzel yourself. She'll kill you because she has to serve and protect Empire.
Yes. Yes.
And Song is obviously furious. But what is the end implication of that? Is you can't free Demerzel as long as Empire exists, right? So,
Well, I mean, the question is, if Empire no longer exists, what happens to Demerzel?
I think she's free at that point. I think she's able to.
But only if somehow that command has been released from her. I don't think that the death of Empire is necessarily going to lift her out from under that stricture of, you know, your primary function is to keep Empire alive, because she's failed in her prime function. I mean, so now I'm back to the whole V'ger thing of execute your prime function. You're flawed. Right?
Yeah. No, that's interesting. So, I think she would at least be able to be tampered with again.
Only if you could somehow put her out of commission.
Well, what if that paradox of save Empire but it doesn't exist, what if that breaks her brain, her positronic brain? Can't handle it. Just like in the robot novels. Well, but in the robot novels, the robots, if they accidentally hurt somebody, their positronic brain just goes haywire and they can't handle it. So I wonder if this is like such a breach of the prime directive here, of her zeroth law.
Yeah.
Will she break and will somebody be able to fix her in a way that gives her freedom?
If her breaking doesn't deteriorate all of her systems.
Right.
I mean, how do we, you know, how far does the breaking go?
Right.
And by the way, she gives us three names that she has had. You mentioned Daniil. There's also Ito and Cheddar.
Are those books significant?
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. Well, yes, I only know about Daniil because I've read a couple of the robot books.
Right. Right. Well, if you had time, I would urge you to read the two prequel novels. I'm just astounded at how much material they're pulling out of them. No.
Interesting.
What I found really touching when Demerzel says, "I cannot weigh love against freedom," she guesses that if she were free, I would make more beings like myself, more robots.
Yeah.
Which is, again, a generative desire. It's almost as if she yearns to be a mother, to be a procreator in one fashion or another. And if, you know, if she's struggling so hard with these more or less human constructs, would it be easier with, you know, a baby robot?
It's also really interesting that, because we were debating, could she make more of herself, right? I think she did say she was the key to more of her kind at some point, but like the question is, could she? I know she's the key, but could she herself do it? And I think she could, based on this conversation.
You may be right. Another thing that pops in my mind is when Day tells Songbird that even if you tried to free her, she would kill you.
Right.
What Songbird's response is, that means you have violated her.
Right.
You know, you have broken her integrity. You've done something horrible to her. And, you know, Day's response, well, it wasn't me. Me personally, it wasn't this iteration. I wasn't even around at that point. So
right. Yeah. Darn that Cleon the First.
I know, I'm telling you. And how is it that Songbird knows Demerzel's lullaby?
Or was that just blending?
I wasn't quite clear. It could well have just been blending, but I did wonder, you know, was this something that been handed down amongst the members of the inheritance for 5,000 years?
Yeah, I could see it go either way. I think it could have been blending. It could have been something passed down like a secret song. But who knows?
Can I just say that Sunmaster really looks some Egyptian to me?
I didn't think his voice matched his face.
I didn't either. I said exactly same thing.
He's going to be very old, and he was right. Not.
The gray beard, whatever. It's like, oh my gosh.
He could be Egyptian all he wants or Arabic all he wants. I thought he'd be older with that voice.
I did too. It was interesting. I mean, the older voice conveys this notion of, you know, wisdom, longevity, the elder, clearly head of the quote unquote tribe or the, the inheritance, cultus or whatever it happens to be.
Right.
And, you know, he got the staff with a skull-like figure on the top. And I think he calls it the brazen face of God. And supposedly it's going to scream days fade aloud. And I thought, you know, we're kind of off the sci-fi rails at this point. We're so deep into religion and cult.
Well, I think religion and cults are well trodden in sci-fi.
Yes. And not so much in the Foundation series and in Asimov's whole notion.
He was not a fan.
No. Remember that the Foundation went through, quote, a religious phase, and it was a good thing when it was done.
Right.
And again, this mirrors the books insofar as having the Mycogens have this cult-like society that harkens back to a religion that goes back thousands of years. I mean, that all tracks. But they didn't have these kinds of rituals. So again, visual medium, maybe this makes it more powerful. But it was interesting. It was odd. And I wasn't on the drugs, so it wasn't any drug induced anything. I just thought, all right, this is weird. And he is Sunmaster 80, whereas in the book he was Sunmaster. But maybe that reflects, you know, the...
Because those were the prequels, right? So
those are the prequels.
So now more time has passed. So maybe it's just saying, all right, this is a different story.
It could have been 76 generations.
Yeah.
In the future. Anyway, all very interesting material and very interesting. Look forward to see what they're going to do with it all.
Absolutely. I am very excited. So let's finish out the episode with the Mallows.
Oh, yes.
Torin carries Beta to their ship and places her in the escape pod with a medical unit working on her. Uncle Randu appears in the ship and tries to convince Torin to join the mule. Torin realizes his uncle has been converted and soldiers arrive to capture them all. They take Beta and shoot Randu, but Torin narrowly escapes in the pod, screaming all the way up.
Yeah, that was a horrible exit, wasn't it? And can I just say, I don't think that Beta had been put in the escape pod. I think she had been put in sick bay.
I think it was an escape pod. It was the same pod that he ended up in. I don't think it was, John. Really?
I don't think it was.
I am pretty sure, but I'll go back and check. But it doesn't fundamentally change either way, I don't think. But I think that the sick bay and the pod were one and the same.
Well, listeners, write in. We can both go and rewatch it and see what.
Yeah, maybe I have to rewatch this. Maybe I'm crazy.
Well, I was all very confusing in my first view, but in the second view, I just noticed these differences. I mean, at first, I thought that Torin had shot Randu through the head, through the window, and I thought, well, there goes his safety pod, right? But in the second viewing, I said, oh no, he was shot from behind.
Oh yeah, no, that was the mule's man. He didn't. So, I think he just didn't. He couldn't bring himself to do it.
Oh, I'm sure he couldn't. I'm sure he couldn't, and he didn't need to in the end, if you look at it in that way.
Right.
Yeah, and the line that Randu takes, the mule's problem is with the powers that be. He's fine with people like us. We'll have a chance to make the bastards pay up. And now, of course, I'm right back to that first scene of this episode and the experience on Rossin, which... certainly inspired the older child to want to make the bastards pay up. So
yeah,
you can see where all of this vituperative class warfare kind of stuff is coming from. But so incredibly poignant when Randu tells Torin, you don't have to prove anything. As a result of, look at all what you've done. You know, it's fabulous. It's wonderful. And Torin almost chokes, saying, yeah, I used to wish you'd say that. But of course, now with this whole mind control thing, who knows who's talking there?
Right.
It's certainly not Uncle Randu, free of any influence and with all his faculties.
I did double check just now, by the way, with the subtitles. It says evac modules crash is already, medical crash is already working to stabilize her. So it was the evac module that Beta was in.
Okay, well, they must have had more than one, because I don't think that was the one that Torin ran to. How? Because the whole timing of it, they carried her out.
I think it is the same one, but
he seemed to open something new and get into it and close it, but I don't know.
Well, I think they took her out and then it closed and then he went back to it. Anyway, it doesn't really matter that much to the plot.
No, it doesn't.
I just wanted to before we get a slew of emails, it was the escape pod.
All right. Well, that certainly makes more sense. But everything was going pretty quickly, and as I say, I did not have closed captions. So
yeah, we got to figure out why your closed captions aren't working.
I don't know. That initially when I wrote in, they were fabulous, and after the initial things I tried and I reported, no, it didn't work. I haven't heard anything from them.
I don't know.
Maybe they don't have any answers.
Could be.
You know, they're not all-seeing and all-knowing, even with technology.
Yeah. And where is Magnifico?
Yeah. Hello. The last time I remember seeing him was falling flat on his face in the field outside the null field of the vault on New Terminus. Because now, military mule, Viking mule, is able to make Inber enjoy his own death, which he claimed in the Stargate he could not do because he'd lost his balladeer. So,
does he have him back?
Does he? But why aren't we seeing him?
I don't know.
However, I think Magnifico has to still be around, because with Beta being taken, he may be the only one that can make sure she's all right.
Does he have that power? I guess he has the Visi sonar.
He has the Visi sonar. He and you know, his defense of her in multiple situations. I don't know. It could be.
Yeah.
And maybe it couldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, this was just a tragic scene with Randu. You talked about this whole, like, wanting acceptance earlier, so I don't think we need to rehash that. I thought it was a great way to show conversion. I mean, we've seen people that we don't know be converted, but this was the first time I think we saw somebody that we already knew and liked be converted.
Yes.
And that, I think, is more interesting to watch.
It definitely is, and it's also more devastating because, you know, I wanted Randu to have been saying these things all along, his nephew. And now to hear them, I mean, it's just Torin's utter devastation. You know, he's hearing them now, and it was the thing he most wanted in all the world, maybe, and suddenly now he gets it, but it's completely meaningless. And that's just really, really grievous.
That and the fact that this is someone who based his whole life on resistance, and now he just goes,
yeah,
you've never felt such love, he says.
Yeah,
and that's a huge
statement.
Quite not just reverence or not, you know, loyalty, but love.
Yeah.
And we see the mule in the end, in the flashback, saying, you love me and you love being under the water, right? Like,
yes, that
seems to be what he wants more than all.
Yeah, and it's almost like, you know, I have to kill you, but I'll anesthetize you first.
Right.
I'm going to kill you, but you'll be happy. which, yeah, it's so messed up. Just so messed up.
Right.
By the by, I forgot earlier to mention we were talking about Demerzel's appearance in, Day's rather trippy drugs thing. There's one scene in which she's at the end of a corridor and you see this very long neck and almost a head that could be almost like a bird head, and her arms are hollow but down on either side, making these sort of semicircles. I really was thinking of Nile goddesses And I did have a couple of links here. If we think any of them are worthwhile sufficiently, we can put them in the notes or somewhere else. And I can just put them in the chat too, as far as that goes. But this the extent to which Bukhari collaborated with the version of Demerzel, Creation of Psychohistory, definitely tracks with the extent we're seeing it here now. So again, having that background knowledge is, that's really pretty amazing.
Yeah. I really like this idea of these bird goddess images that you posted. I guess people could just look up a bird goddess, a Nile goddess.
Yeah, there's a lot of different stuff out there, and a lot of it doesn't look anything like what we see.
Okay.
In this particular scene, but I think it's sort of an amalgamation.
Yeah.
But yes, just go ahead on yourself if you want. I picked out a couple of specific ones that were most similar to.
Maybe you could post them in the Discord.
Sure. No, I'll do that. I will do that for sure.
Sounds good. Any other speculations you want to talk about?
Oh, tons and tons if you think they're all safe.
I mean, we could just move it till after the credits if any of them are not safe.
Yeah.
But I think it looks like there's a lot of them that are safe from book spoilers.
All right. Well, I'll start off, and if they're not safe, you tell me, and I'll move on to the next one.
Edit it out.
You can edit. You have the power. You have the power to make me sound better than I am. So, first thought, on the Discord channel, there were many listeners speculating as to why Hara didn't tell Gale about Demerzel's part in the development of the Prime Radiant. And my first thoughts on that were, I don't think that Hara ever shared the entire plan with anybody.
That's true.
With the possible exception of Raish, but of course, Raish is dead. But he does make sure that several people know large chunks of the whole. And so this may be his own form of installing redundancy that, we heard Gale talk about, the second foundation as a redundancy for the first. And of course, throw two mentalists into the whole picture and it does tend to skew things. And at the same time, it's been made clear to us from the beginning that Gale was not supposed to be there at all. Raish was supposed to be the one to start the second foundation. And that too is very much in keeping with the books. And there's also a possibility that Harry simply wanted to take all the credit for himself and didn't want anybody to know that he had taken the data from a robot.
Mm-hmm.
Which, on the one hand, would be shocking in and of itself because there aren't supposed to be any robots.
Right.
Right. And that could just completely overtake societies and planets and whatever. And also the Prime Radiant. In fact, there's a significant quote here from Prelate Foundation. After all, you, Harry, are vain enough to want full credit for psychohistory. You would not want anyone to know ever that you needed the help of a robot. So, in retrospect, I think that's very much in the keeping with the character of Harry that they're presenting to us.
Right. Yeah, he does have an ego, right? I mean, he literally made himself immortal with redundancy.
Right. Right. Exactly. So another thought, we had gone back and forth about whether or not Day brought drugs, whether the things he bought from the sweet seller were drugs or sweets. And he specifically says to Songbird, I brought you some effing candy. So I think if they were drugs, he would have said effing drugs.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right.
But and we discussed, had anybody said Selden helps those who help themselves recently? And yes, they said it in episode 6. So they do keep putting it in there every so often. And this is the point I mentioned at the very beginning of our recording here. We're beginning to run into one of the real challenges of telling a story which involves the ability to alter people's minds. Because after a while, you start to wonder, did this character do this of their own volition or are they under an influence?
Mm.
And if everybody is under an influence, then what does it matter what they do or don't do? I mean, it's a really tricky thing to handle. And yeah. I can't name any other stories that I know that use this sort of thing at the moment, but I'm already finding myself thinking, so-and-so did this or that. but maybe they're under the influence.
Yeah, we will have to see how they handle it. This could go very badly in a storytelling.
I think so.
A sense, but I think it could go really well. I think the books handle it really well, and I'm hoping the show continues that.
Yeah, and I was beginning to wonder, is it possible that Demrizel might have rescued Dawn in time and have him stashed away somewhere, ready to come forth at an unexpected moment? Again, going back to my whole thing of, you know, she said, oh, you weren't dead, Gale. Your heart just stopped.
I think that she probably has Dawn shoved into her chest cavity like the Prime Radiant.
Oh, gosh, there's an image I really didn't need.
It's like a TARDIS, you know? It's bigger on the inside.
Thank you, thank you. Because we've all said, oh, and Gale herself says, well, you can just go back and decant another one. And that's when she has this really, really ferocious outburst of, I raised him.
Yeah.
So that might argue for the fact that, yeah, not really, not this time.
I think Demrizel believes that Dawn is dead. I do think that Demrizel believes Dawn is dead. I don't know if Dawn is dead, but I
tend to agree with you. Yeah, I don't think he can still be alive without Demrizel intervention somehow.
Yeah.
And of course, if, you know, as I hypothesized, Dusk is going to use the black hole bomb on Trantor, it doesn't matter how many decantings Demrizel might or might not do, because I'm assuming that, you know, the whole cloning apparatus is not going to survive being attacked by a black hole.
No. Well, so, I am excited to see where all this goes. But for now, absolutely, I think we have to keep our lips sealed until after the credits, where we will be talking about some book spoilers.
Yes, we will.
So for now, let's do a quick outro. Make sure that you check out all the affiliates. Nevermind the Music is doing their weekly coverage of music and psychology. Lovely stuff over there. We keep shouting out Mark to answer our music questions when you can't remember things. So thank you. And Properly Howard Movie Review, they are covering Bacon Wrapped, which is a 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon type of draft of movies. They're having a very fun time. They, you know, silly breakdowns of movies. You'll have a good time. Wool Shift Dust is doing their Dune series, and Alicia will also be on the Star Wars Canon Timeline feed again soon, doing more Canon Timeline, Star Wars Canon Timeline reviews in order without spoilers. Radioactive Rambling is doing their Fallout lore, and they'll be covering Fallout in December when it comes back. And Marilyn, you have your own podcast, Rings and Rituals. I can't talk tonight. where you are talking with Dr. Sarah Brown about season one of Rings of Power, and I know you'll be back before season three to talk about season two.
That's the plan, and I am looking forward to it, but I can't start my rewatches taking notes until after we're past Foundation, so.
Fair enough.
We probably won't start the recording until early in 2026, but definitely be able to broadcast things leading right up to the first episode of season three of Rings of Power.
Very good. All right. Well, I'm excited to hear more from everybody on the network. On the network, we just had Alicia and John are putting out a podcast this week. I think it should be out by the time this drops. On Peacemaker, they're recapping season one. Yes. Yes. And they're going to be prepping you for season two. Also, David is covering Alien Earth full time. He's doing full coverage of Alien Earth. I watched the first episode, fantastic, and I listened to their coverage, also fantastic. They talk about how they use child psychologists to help the actors act. They talk about how, a lot of different production issues, how it relates to the prequels that already were out, and I learned a lot just listening to their podcast. I was like, huh, this Lorehounds podcast is pretty good. So go check out David's Alien Earth coverage. On the first two episodes, he had Alicia and Luke, also hosts of Wool Shift Dust. So
very cool.
Check that out. We're going to be doing Second Breakfast on Poutine this month for subscribers, as well as covering a movie that has yet to be... I think it's going to be Airplane. I don't know if the poll has ended, but like Airplane is like 15 votes ahead. So it's going to be Airplane.
Seems pretty definitive.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a fun one. So if you want to hear us talk about Airplane, don't call me Shirley. Just sign up for the, sign up for the Supercaster Patreon. All right. Plenty of other stuff coming. Marilyn,
including just recently dropped as of this recording, Alicia did a one shot for seasons 1 through 3.
Ah, yes.
Of the Gilded Age.
Thank you for reminding me. I was trying to remember all the things we have. We have too many things going on.
Too many things to remember.
The Gilded Age with our lovely contributor and moderator of the community, Brian8063, and his sister.
Oh, how wonderful.
His sister, Red Zippy.
I haven't seen any, well, I've only seen 1 or 2 episodes of season 1, but I might just go ahead and listen to their one shot, even though I will be monumentally spoiled, but you can kind of see where the major plot threads are probably going to go, so.
I think you're going to really enjoy their coverage. They had, I know they talked for a long time, and they had a great time with it. Alicia was saying how good everything was, so listen to Brian, Lisa, and Alicia. I had to enunciate there. Yes. I see Alicia made special art for it and everything. This is great. Wow. So go check it out. Go listen.
Definitely.
All right, everybody. Quick thank yous. We have our Discord server boosters, Aaron K, Tilly the Thriller, Doove71, Athena A, Lestu, Nancy M, Ghost of Partition, and Radioactive Richard, and our lore masters, Samartian, Michael G, Michelle E, Brian P, SC, Peter OH, Adam S, Nancy M, Doove71, Brian8063. Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Matthew M, Sarah M, Andra B, Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T, Alex V, Sub-Zero, Aaron K, Dally V, Mothership 61, Gnarls, Kathy W, Lestu, Jeffrey B, Elisa U, Neil F, Ben B, Scott F, Stephen N, Julia F, Kali S, Ilmariel, /Tim, Paul K, Bobby C, Jessica H, Red Zippy, Lisa, she is our newest lore master. Thank you for joining, Lisa.
Thank you
for being on the Gilded Age. I'm looking forward to listening to that episode. Well, I'll listen to the spoiler-free section because I've never watched the show.
There you go.
All right, and Adrian is our last one. I don't want to skip our always last Adrian.
But never least.
That's right.
Thank you, everybody. It really helps enormously, and it's great to have such a wonderful crew. And it's fun to hear from all of you on the Discord channel.
Absolutely. And again, if you want to hear book spoilers or you're not averse to them or you've read the books, stick around after the credits. We're going to talk about some theories.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening. All right, Marilyn, we've got some things to talk about here.
Oh, we sure do.
So I jotted down some of your notes. So why don't you start with that speculation you wanted to talk about earlier?
Which one? About the mule?
I wrote it after the outro down here. The mule being the older child. Or the younger child.
Yeah, it's interesting to reflect. I mean, my first thought was, well, okay, maybe he is. And maybe the baby becomes Magnifico because insufficient food intake as an infant can develop, you know, affect brain development and all kinds of other things. But I just don't know. They're coding him visually and also in terms of the, you know, suddenly getting these abilities to tell people I'm going to drown you and you're going to love it, which are certainly coded to the Viking mule, as I like to call him, in the series. But the very last thing where he puts the child down on the stoop and leaves his last piece of candy with him, at first I thought, oh, well, good, he has enough money to do that. And then I thought, but why? Why does he not drown his little brother, who was also mm-hmm. or sister, whoever?
Well, he didn't try to kill him.
Well, true, but still, you know, this was the one that was responsible for, you know.
I mean, he wasn't responsible.
Mommy and Daddy loved you more than they loved me.
I mean, you know. Yeah, you could see a child reacting like that, but I think
he is older than that.
Yeah, you could also see a child not reacting like that and being like, you didn't do anything wrong. This was our parents. You know, we didn't have to fight.
Right, right. No, exactly, exactly. But then at the end, when Seldon says, you know, a very sad story, I wonder if it is true.
I think he said, I wonder how much of it is true.
How much of it is true.
And I think that's right. I think Mule's completely full of shit here, but not wittingly. Not wittingly. I think,
yes,
I think,
exactly.
I think this Mule is not the Mule. I think Magnifico is still the Mule. And I think that this is an implanted memory from Magnifico.
Which then begs the question, well, who is Magnifico? Which is why I was thinking initially, well, maybe the baby brother.
Yeah.
Because if it's just some random pirate, that's a little more, I don't know, a little less satisfactory to me somehow.
I think that the Mule was the pirate that was terrorizing them. And Magnifico, as the Mule, joined up with the pirate. Because he said, I joined up with the pirate that was terrorizing us, right? So I think Magnifico grew up, joined up with the pirate, and then made the pirate think he was the Mule and implanted these memories.
Interesting. So we don't know anything about the origin of the Magnifico.
Right. I mean, it could be that part of that is true. Like maybe that happened to Magnifico, but not, you know, that person was would look more like Magnifico, right? The kid would look more like Magnifico.
Yeah. Yeah, I really do have to say that visually they were really leading us down the path of, yes, this is the one who you see.
Yeah,
you know,
this is the real
Mule. And
I think it's, I'm glad that they added Harry at the end because it kept my hope alive.
I'll be interested to see if, you know, what happens with the younger Sib.
Yeah, I did enjoy that they said, I thought it was interesting that they said he took up with a pirate. Like I said, I think that is who the Mule is, who the outward Mule is that pirate. Also, Han was not affected. We talked about that when he was running up to the Mule. He was not affected this time, and the Mule wasn't trying to get into him. Of course not, because this Mule is not the Mule. And and Magnifico is missing right now, so he's on the planet. I think Magnifico, first of all, is the one who over broadcast was able to, you know, turn all these pilots, turn all these captains. I think when he was playing in that room, he was converting the people there.
Oh yeah.
But he left out Beta and Torin because in the books, there was this whole thing of the Mule wanted to leave Beta pure because Beta actually liked him and was kind to him. And he didn't want to take away the genuineness of her love for him.
Right. She was the only one who ever showed him any affection and kindness.
Right. And right. And maybe she leaves him. She calls Torin her pet, right? Maybe he doesn't take Torin seriously. And he's like, whatever, I'll leave the pet untouched so she's happy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much how my thoughts have been trending all along.
Yeah.
And that's why I said what I said about, you know, maybe Beta will be protected by, you know, Magnifico.
Right.
When she's isolated by herself on a new foundation ruled by the military Mule.
Right.
It's hard to get terms of reference here.
I know. I'm calling him like the outward Mule, the public face, the face of Mule, like the face of Bo and Dr. I don't know. I think I am still firmly planted in Magnifico as the Mule. The Mule is really a puppet. He's a figurehead.
Yeah, I'm still of that mind as well. And we just have to wait and see.
I think also I just think that they're going to drag this out to the end. I think this is going to be a big finale reveal. We don't even have access to the finale right now.
No.
But so trust me, I'm not spoiling it. And I think you could tell based on our coverage that we've not been watching ahead because we've been wrong about things.
Yes.
I think they're going to save this one for the finale, this reveal. And book readers are guessing it already, but I think that they're going to keep us on our toes until the finale.
Yeah, because otherwise, you know, we don't get the same pleasure of, you know,
right,
surprise, astonishment, whatever that the non-book readers do.
Right,
from the whole beginning, it may be somewhat less of a reveal for us, but it's still a reveal because they keep teasing it.
We have enough doubts, right?
We have enough doubts. We have enough doubts.
Any other thoughts on book spoilery stuff before we head out of here?
Well, another thing I discovered just today in my continued read-through of Prelude to Foundation is a deeper discussion of the whole zeroth law.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a character who says, but what is humanity? To what can we point when we speak of humanity? And how can we define harm to humanity? When will a course of action do more good than harm to humanity as a whole? And how can one tell? The robot who first advanced the zeroth law died, became impermanently inactive. Because he was forced into an action that he felt would save humanity, yet which he could not be sure would save humanity. The zeroth law makes no allowance for unwitting harm.
Hmm. Was it Daniil that said this?
Yeah.
Okay. We're in book spoiler territory.
His name wasn't Daniil in the
Okay, in but it was Daniil. It was this one robot. Daniil
in his iteration as Cheddar Hutton, Hummin as Ito Demerzel.
It's really interesting to watch how Asimov linked these different series, right? Because the first two robot books, I haven't read the third robot book or the fourth robot book, and I think the fourth one is where he really links it to the Empire and Foundation series.
Uh-huh.
But the first two robot books are really just procedurals. They're really just like detective novels that happen to have a robot.
Yeah. I got partway through the first one and I was foreseeing a really unhappy turn and I just thought, I'm going to set this aside for now.
It's not too dark, honestly.
No, I'm sure it isn't, but I just didn't want, you know, the unhappiness of a little kid because they were taking away a robot who she loved.
Fair enough.
So.
Well, I think we have a very exciting rest of the season for us. I think we're going to have a really good time. I'm excited to watch. Maybe I'll go watch the next episode now because I am fiending.
I can't watch it now, but I'm almost certainly going to watch it tomorrow at lunchtime.
Yeah. All right. Well, enjoy, Marilyn. And we'll be back next week with episode 8.
Yes. Can't wait. Bye, everybody.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.